Ivan Exoneri from the state of Kentucky.
Hi, this is Stephanie.
And this is Matt.
You might have heard our names in the credits.
We're part of the volunteer team.
We're whispering because Brooke doesn't know we put this clip in here, but we're pretty sure she wouldn't mind.
You see, Monday was Brooke's birthday, and she spent it working on the show. So we were hoping you can help us celebrate her birthday by leaving positive reviews or pledging a dollar on Patreon.
I hope she uploads a singing happy birthday on Patreon.
Thanks for your help.
Now back to the show.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of Actual Innocence. I just have a couple of announcements before we get started. 2 weeks ago, I asked for volunteers to help transcribe episodes, and I was met with an abundance of volunteers. I can't tell you how touched I was by the willingness of people to help out. But just to let you know, I'm no longer in need of that kind of volunteer. So thank you so much to everyone who contacted me or is thinking about doing that. I really appreciate it. You should probably check out the website, www.actualinpod.com, if you haven't yet. The transcripts will be posted there, along with a couple of other new pages, including the one with the open volunteer positions for my show, and another that will be connecting agencies that need volunteers to people who would like to volunteer. Now, a word about the show Conviction, and then Edwin's story. Conviction is a new crime drama airing on Mondays at 10, 9 central on ABC. What makes this show different is that while most crime stories end behind bars, that's where Conviction begins. Each year, over 10,000 people in America are wrongly convicted. They could be victims of forensic errors, evidence tampering, and more. Inspired by real-life conviction integrity units across the country, the CIU's purpose is to review potentially wrongful verdicts, investigate, then recommend that the sentence be overturned or let stand. And they have just 5 days per case. The CIU team, made up of attorneys, a former detective, and forensic experts, is led by Hayes Morrison, an ex-president's daughter and reformed party girl, who now stands as a defender for the unjustly prosecuted. She's not afraid to raise a little hell and is known not only for her feisty attitude, but also her willingness to question every part of the judicial system. This week's Torn from the Headlines episode finds the CIU reinvestigating the case of a mother convicted for murdering her autistic son, the ultimate sin. But Hayes Morrison suspects reasonable doubt and that the system works against this seemingly caring mother. What secret is this family hiding? Or is the mother really guilty of this heinous homicide? It's a case that will have you guessing and second-guessing right up to the very last minute of the episode. From the executive producer of Criminal Minds, Conviction airs Mondays at 10, 9 central, after Dancing with the Stars on ABC. Edwin Chandler was convicted and served almost 10 years in prison for a manslaughter and an armed robbery he did not commit. His exoneration would not come until 10 years later and after he was paroled, but luckily he did not give up the fight for justice. Mr. Chandler was speaking to me from his car, so there's a little bit of background noise, and you might occasionally hear some narration from his GPS. I am so thankful that exonerees take the time to speak with me. And who knows the importance of their time more than someone who's had their time unjustly stolen from them? I will not ask them to reschedule so that I can have better sound quality. So, without further delay, I'm Brooke, and this is Edwin's story.
So I guess my life was typical for, you know, a young black man. I've dealt with some issues in my life. I think just like not just black people, but like a lot of people, you know. I don't think my life was so much harder or dramatic than anybody else's, you know. I had my hardships and then I had my windfalls as well. And this is just me looking back on it now, you know. I think I have a better grasp on who I was back then and what I was trying to accomplish and where I was trying to head. I was in Louisville, Kentucky.
Being such a young man at the time, I asked Edwin what his family life was like before he was arrested.
My mother passed away in March of 93. So maybe like 5-6 months before I was arrested for all of this. My mother passed away of breast cancer complications. And then 5 months after I got arrested, my father passed away of cancer complications as well. Well, he had pneumonia. And he had cancer of the larynx, so he didn't have a voice box or anything. And he caught pneumonia and could not overcome it. So I had lost both my parents. I was living with my sister. I have a younger sister. And she had 2 kids at the time, actually. So, I mean, I was living with family. You know, I still had, you know, family members and family ties. It just wasn't very strong, you know, because I had lost my mother.
Brenda Whitfield was a 25-year-old mother of 2 young children, working alone at a Chevron gas station, when a man walked in and proceeded to make a purchase. When she opened the cash register, he produced a weapon and shot Mrs. Whitfield in the face, killing her. He took the money from the drawer and left the store.
The only thing I can tell you about the actual crime, I mean, was that somebody else committed it.
I asked Mr. Chandler if he had remembered where he was at the time he was told this crime took place.
I was with my sister and I was with my girlfriend at the time and a few associates. It was no different a day than what today is right now. I'm on my way in South Atlanta to go and watch some of the games, you know, because I haven't been able to get out of the house. So it really wasn't much of different of a day than today is. I was just hanging out with some family and friends and associates.
I asked if he knew what made the police consider him as a suspect.
I just recently learned why the police sought after me. I mean, and after all of this time, it's been almost 25 years. I haven't really gotten a true understanding of it, but from what I gather, a Louisville Metro police officer suggested that they need to take a look at me because he worked a caseload that my name was brought up in. Now, I know that this sounds, I mean, like weird and all of that, but this is the way that my attorneys have explained it to me, is that there was a Louisville Metro police officer that felt like they should take a look at me because my name was on a caseload or something that he had in the past or something. You know, it was nothing credible for them to look at me for. Just a so-called cop's hunch.
I wondered if he remembered where he was when he was first arrested and what his interaction with the police was like.
My interaction with the police was I had been arrested before for a minor incident, but nothing major at all. I had never been arrested for a felony at all. The strongest charge I had been arrested of was driving without license. I had a public intoxication charges. You know, I was like 17, 18, 19, you know what I mean? When I caught those little charges there, you know, and I just stemmed that from being young and ignorant to a lot of issues, you know, a lot of things that I was supposed to do, like get my driver's license instead of riding around on a permit. I didn't have a great interaction with the police. I turned myself in. You know, they didn't come and pick me up. You know, nothing like that happened at all. I mean, the interrogation was brutal, honestly. Because the whole time I was in there, basically, it was the police demanding that I had committed a murder that I knew that I hadn't committed, you know.
I told Mr. Chandler that I had read that he had given a false confession while being interrogated, and I asked if he could tell me some more about that. And then he turned the interview around on me.
Honestly, I just felt like this individual was a screwed up individual. That he wasn't gonna, he's not the type of person who believed anybody. So I felt like once this got away from his hands and somebody else seen it and looked at it, then they would understand where everything was at. And you know, like, I just honestly, I didn't believe that I was being locked up. The worst feeling that I've ever had. I guess maybe when my parents passed, it rivals in comparison to that. You know what I mean? You know, it's just like, let me ask you a question. Do you have any siblings?
I have one brother.
You have a brother. Did you grow up with that brother?
I did, and he is 8 years younger than me, so I was really protective of him.
Okay. Now, has your brother ever made you upset, mad at him?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So, has your brother ever maybe said to your mother and father that you did something that you maybe didn't do?
Probably, yeah.
You think you got in trouble for it?
Probably.
You know how that feels?
Yep.
Imagine a million times that. Imagine a million times that, you know. Because that's somebody that you love and who loves you. And you know that. And you know that in your heart. There's nothing, nobody ever can tell you that your brother doesn't love you. You understand? But this was from people that I did not know at all, completely. Like total strange. And when you're being lied upon, you don't look at that as I am okay with this. It's gonna be fine. You know, things will work itself out. You don't really want to think about all of that. You're just thinking like, why is this person doing this? And then you want to be like, for your parents, why are you believing it? Why are you believing it? To sum that up, it was like everywhere that I turned to try and tell somebody that this was all a lie, it was like nobody believed. Even in my trial, when I went to trial over this, it was so difficult. Like, they did so many bad things to me, and in the course of the trial that the judges allowed, it's like you wonder at some point, is this really how the system works? Is this systematically how things work?
I wondered if he had had an appointed or a retained counsel.
He was a pro bono attorney. And then that's another situation. When I was first arrested, my attorney, for the first 6 months that I was arrested, for the first 6 months, that I was arrested, my attorney did nothing. He did absolutely zero. He didn't go and talk to any of the people that I had asked him to go and talk to. He didn't go and investigate anything that I asked him to go and investigate. I mean, absolutely nothing. Until the I guess the prosecutor's office let him know that the evidence was available for him to look at and that they had hair samples that they had found in the guy's hat, toboggan, like stocking or whatever they call it. After he got notion that the fingerprints were available, he took and come back to me and wanted me to take a today we call it a DNA test. Back then, it was a standard rate kit. Okay? It was a standard rate kit. And through this, they took her follicles from me. They, ran them up against the hair samples that they had held in the stocking hat, whatever, and come back. There was not a match. There was never a match with me and any DNA linking me to anything with this crime. And they know that the person who committed this crime left her hat, glasses, and, you know, whatever item that they had left. So when my attorney realizes that I'm not matching or the hat that was in the hat, he moved to try and get the charges dropped. But the prosecutor pressed the judge to keep the charge, going. So they did. And so they wanted me to go to, they set me up for what is called a suppression hearing. And my attorney tried to suppress the evidence. And the evidence was not suppressed based off of the detective telling the judge that he hadn't committed any type of perjury or any type of, he didn't tell me what to do or anything, you know, anything wrong at all. But his partner got on the stand right behind him and told them, yes, you know, in fact, this is how this happens, bloop, 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 you know, da-da-da-da-da. Well, maybe I got that the other way around. Mark Handy is the detective in question here. Mark Handy tells the judge that, yes, you know, he cooperated with me. I did tell him this, that, and the other about the case, that, and the other. Well, his partner gets on the stand and tells the judge, well, we don't operate that way. We don't tell defendants anything about the actual crime or anything like that. So there's the contradiction between the two right there. And instead of them dropping the charges against me right then, they did not do it. They allowed the charges to go through. In fact, the judge was supposed to rule on that suppression hearing the day that my trial was supposed to start. The day that my trial started, they postponed the trial because there was a new judge sitting over on the case who was going to rule on the suppression hearing. So that judge took 24 hours to view my suppression hearing and rule on it. And he ruled against me, and I had to go to trial.
I asked Mr. Chandler if it was a jury trial and how long it had lasted. And he said it was a trial by jury and that it had lasted about a week. I asked him what the jury was like. Did they look like him? Did they look like me? Not that he could see what I looked like. Or were they a diverse group of people?
No, it wasn't really a lot of diversity on my jury. You know, there wasn't. For whatever reason, you know, it was what the jury pools had for us to select out of. And during the hors d'oeuvre process, you know, you have to strike out. You have strikes that you utilize that, you know, people that you may feel like are totally against you, you have to utilize them. And then the prosecutor has the same amount of strikes as you do. And anybody that the prosecutor feels like is in your favor, he's going to strike and take off of the jury pool. So, you know, like, the jury selection, I don't feel comfortable with the jury selection in America, honestly. Something else has to be done as far as that process. Because you can get too many of the same like-minded people easily. I had a major discussion with my wife just today. Like, when we see things on television, and when we see things in the media, that right there, those opinions can be so strong that it really infects other people. And so a lot of people are feeling the same way and they're looking the same way over this one situation. It's really based off of everyone else. It's not really based off of the one individual making a single choice to be this way. It's made based off of because everybody else feels this way. And a lot of times, we as people, we want to say that we have these beliefs on this, we have these beliefs on that, but they're really not your beliefs.
I wondered how long it had taken the jury to come to a verdict.
The jury deliberated like 24 hours.
and what verdict they had come to.
This is something else. Like, originally I was charged with murder in the first degree and robbery in the first degree. I was convicted of manslaughter in the second degree and robbery in the first degree. Okay? Now, with that said, anybody who has any affiliation with the judicial system as far as, you know, the court system, actually the workings of the court system and things of that nature, should know and understand what I just said is totally wrong. It's totally wrong. The charges that I just read out to you, well, the convictions of the charges don't add up at all.
I clarified for myself that he had been charged with murder in the first degree and robbery in the first degree, but was convicted of different charges. I didn't even think that was possible. It kind of sounded like the jury had reached a bargain to me. I asked what prison was like for him.
Anytime you're taken away from your environment and placed in a prison, it's not going to be good. It's not going to be good at all. I mean, I had difficulties, not necessarily like of the physical nature to where I was really like afraid of my life, like somebody was trying to kill me inside. It wasn't anything like that. It was just the point that I knew that I was in a place that I wasn't supposed to be. I was being treated unfairly by the staff. I was being treated, I mean, like, some of these corrections officers that work in corrections really don't need to be there, honestly. I mean, they are taking out their frustrations and whatever issues that they are having, they're taking them out on those inmates. I've seen it too many times, and I've had it done to me too many times over the course of 10 years, you know. And it's a shame that being in the situation that you already in, let's say that I was in prison for doing something, okay? It's not benefiting me any good that I got a corrections officer in here mistreating me bad. That's not rehabilitation. As a matter of fact, the word rehabilitation shouldn't even exist, honestly. Do you know what this word means, rehabilitation? Do you know what the word rehabilitation means? It means to rehabilitate something, to rehabilitate. But you can't rehabilitate anything. You can't rehabilitate anything, okay, from my perspective of it. You can't rehabilitate anything. When you break this word down, re means to do over. Am I correct?
I once again felt like I was the one being interviewed, but definitely not in a negative way.
So if you're going to do it over, so what does habilitate mean? To help, right? So, but you want me to go to re-help myself. You want me to re-help myself to doing the same stuff that I was just doing? If a person needs rehabilitation, then they probably don't have the necessary tools, mental capacity, as what other people have in this same area, for whatever it is, mentally. I hope I said that correctly. Because they're going back to the same environment, to the same people, there is no rehabilitation there. What I'm telling you is that it boils down to the individual. I understand that. It boils down to the individual. What do you want to do with your life? Some people don't want to stretch their hands forward to receive the plate of food that they're going to eat from. Some people would rather stretch their arms out to receive that plate. Me, myself, I would rather stretch my own arms out to receive whatever plate of food God has for me. I would rather not wait on it. I would rather not wait on it. I would rather not be lazy to have somebody push it to me. That's the issue I think that we have in life, is that one thing that we all have in common, we don't use in common. We don't you know, it's the gift of free will to make that choice and that decision the right one for you as an individual. You know, that don't mean that people need to go out and sell drugs and prostitute, this, that, and the other. That's not what I'm, that's a negative aspect of life. I never want to speak on a negative aspect of life. I only want to speak in positivity in life, you know, and that's in great things and the greater good in things, you know. You know, prison did a lot of things for me. It did some good things for me in hindsight, but like, I mean, as I went through it, honestly, it was just like pure hell.
Mr. Chandler has the unique experience of being the first person I've interviewed who was paroled before their exoneration. I asked him to tell me about that experience.
After I accepted parole from prison, I was on that parole for another 7.5 years. That is a long time for a person to be on parole. On parole. Now, I done 10 years in prison, and now I done another 7.5 years on parole. You know, because once again, here you are, like I had explained before, you're taking an individual. Now prison is my environment. I was in there for 10 years. That was my environment. You understand? So now you've taken me out of my environment and placed me into a totally different environment, and now you expect me to jump into everything that's going on out here and be successful. Got a better one for you. Done that. Because I don't want to die. I don't want to quit. I love my life. I love me too much to give up on me. I'm not giving up on me. No matter what these people, well, I mean, I just pushed forward. When I got me a job, I had obtained skills in prison, so I wasn't skillless. I came out, I got me a job in construction, and I started working. And I started slowly getting myself back acclimated to society. You know, I chose to take my time at it, you know. I chose not to. I think a lot of times when guys get out of prison, they rush into this, that, and the other. And when that happens, you don't give yourself a chance to make the necessary adjustments that you need. Life changes every day. This is something that I do know. I do know this. Life changes every day, whether you know it or not. Life changes every single day. And so with that change, you have to be able to give yourself the amount of space and opportunity to change along with that every day. And I may be, it may sound impossible, but it's not impossible. It's what we all do every day. You get up. You put your clothes on, you wash up or whatever, you get your clothes on and you go out for your work day. When your work day is over, then you try to find some way to relax and kick back, whether you have a family or not, you know, and then you're waiting on the next day to happen. And that's just simply all it is. You go day by day. And I've tried to live day by day by making the right decisions throughout my day.
I asked him what led to the involvement of the Innocence Network agency that helped him to be exonerated.
An associate of mine while I was in prison told me that there was an organization who was helping people, you know, that had been wrongly convicted. This guy was happened to be from Louisville and knew about my situation and told me that, you know, I didn't have nothing to lose in the situation, you know, at all. So, and he was right. I didn't have anything to lose. So there was an introductory packet in the law library in the prison that I was at. I filled out the introductory packet and sent it in to them, and they responded with questions. I answered the questions. We began corresponding for a little while, and then they wanted me to send them, you know, everything on my case that I had. And I did, and before I really heard a definitive kind of like answer from them, I had made parole. there's a lady, she is retired now. Her name was Marguerite Thomas. Marguerite was the director of the Kentucky Innocence Project. And in the midst of that, she came to Louisville and asked me flat out if I wanted her to proceed with, you know, the investigation. And I was just like, you know, definitely, yeah. So once I met her, she quickly involved me with the team that was working with her on these cases. They were students, and then she had an investigator. And through the investigator, I came in contact with a Louisville police detective named Denny Butler. And Denny Butler was the actual detective who got me exonerated. He worked that case backwards and reworked that case and found out everything. Found out who the guy was actually, who the actual perpetrator was. Found out who he was. They got him. He was already locked up in prison. Once they found out that he was in prison, they served him notice in prison. They got whatever junction that they needed. They got a junction to go into prison and do the hair samples. And hair samples came back positive as a match for this guy. And so kind of like now, the rest is history.
I looked for more information about the man who they had found the fingerprints of and only found his name and trial dates, but not a verdict. I don't feel comfortable at this point in my life giving out that man's name. I asked him what advice he had for anyone who might find themselves in a situation of wrongful conviction.
To seek out the Innocence Project wherever you are and to be diligent. Don't give up. You know, this whole process has taken a quarter of my life. It's taken almost 25 years of my life. It's difficult to manage. It's difficult to walk through physically, mentally, and financially. It's difficult. You know, it's been difficult for me in a lot of different areas in my life. But the one thing that I have done and that has stayed constant is that I have not given up on myself. You know, I've never given up on myself. And like I said, throughout all of this, I've always given myself a chance to be a better me. Regardless to what situation I'm in, I'm always trying to be a better person. So I think that right there pans out at the end of the day.
I also asked him what advice he had for us, non-attorneys, who want to help.
That is a really, really, really good question. And I don't have a really definitive answer for that, really. It's just that being aware of these situations is key. Being knowledgeable of these situations is key, because just like it happened to me, it can happen to anybody. And if it happens to somebody that you're close to, you may be the one who has the inside information, who has the inside knowledge to say that, look, I can get you, or I can try and get you some help through this way or through this channel here, you know. But it's only by being aware and being knowledgeable, that there are people who are truly wrongly convicted, you know, in America and abroad.
I'm going to leave you with the story Mr. Chandler told me about his daughter.
You know what? I tell you, the most difficult part of all of this is I've already had to try to explain this to one of my children. My daughter, my oldest daughter, is 13. She knew through school. The day that I was exonerated, we sent her to school because we didn't want her to be affected by all of that, right? Okay? We thought we were doing the right thing by sending her on to school so that she would not be affected by any of this, right? She wouldn't know about it or anything. That was what me and my wife's mindset was. You know what happened, Brooke? The day that I was exonerated, they had it
turn left.
They had it publicly in school on in every school in Jefferson County, Kentucky. The day that I was exonerated, they showed it on TV, sweetie. My daughter knew about it when she got home. She told me and her mother when she got home, y'all was on the news today. Why didn't you tell me about y'all was going on the news? You know, we thinking that we're doing the right thing by protecting her from all of that, and she got it anyway at school. There's really not a lot that we can do as people to try and protect and keep away from trouble, this, that, and the other, because life has a way of showing up and happening. It's just that when life shows up and happens, you have to have enough fortitude and enough, I think, gumption in yourself to try and push through that. However you can push past that, you know, with whatever tools God give you to do that with, you know. It's not something that everybody's able to do, or that something that everybody is able to get through, and you know, it's just not. Everybody's not able to, walk like the life that I've walked. I've lived on both ends of the pendulum as far as I'm concerned, you know. I feel like I'm literally in hell, but then on the other hand, here I am, I feel like, you know, I'm on top of the world in certain instances.
I'm Brooke. Thanks for listening. I'm so excited about my newest sponsor. Are you like me and paid a lot of money for your degree, but haven't been able to get it framed because you don't want to pay the same price for a frame? Or do you feel like you have so many pictures living in your phone that are begging to be on your wall? I have found the answer, and it's called FrameBridge.com. Just this weekend, I ordered a frame for my degree, and it was so easy and affordable, and I got free shipping, both ways. You just go to FrameBridge.com, and you can choose your own frame, or they even have designers that will help you choose. You can upload your photo from your computer, or even directly from Instagram. How neat is that? When you've made your selection, you get to preview your picture in the frame you choose. Or, if you're like me and want to frame a picture or document, you just have to enter the dimensions and they take care of shipping both ways. It was so affordable. Instead of paying hundreds of dollars like at a framing store, the prices start at just $39. And did I mention the shipping is free? Plus, when you use my code ACTUAL, that's ACTUAL, you get 15% off your first order. I love that they have a frame for every style, from clean and classic to more eclectic styles. Plus, they use premium real wood moldings and acid-free mat board and foam board. And their acrylic glazing will never shatter and protects your piece from harmful UV rays. So, get started today framing your photos or art. Go to FrameBridge.com and use my promo code ACTUAL to save an additional 15% off your first order. Remember, just go to FrameBridge.com and use my promo code ACTUAL. That's FrameBridge.com, promo code ACTUAL. Next week, my team and I will be meeting with some exonerees at the Georgia Innocence Project and some listeners at the Atlanta meetup. If you'd like live coverage, you can follow us on Periscope at Actual In Pod. But because of these meetings, there will not be an episode next week. And unfortunately, I've had to postpone the California meetup, but I'll keep you posted on future dates. Now, here's Stephanie with the credits and a reminder how to stay in touch. Thanks for listening.
This episode of Actual Innocence was hosted and produced by Brooke Giddings. The Actual Innocence volunteer team is Stephanie Satilli, Sarah Nelson, Megan Delaney, with production assistance from Matt Ryan. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Twitter at ActualInPod, that's Actual I-N-P-O-D, or email us at ActualInnocencePod@gmail.com. Visit our website, www.actualinpod.com, and check out the new links on how to volunteer for the show and your local innocence organizations. Special thanks to our sponsors, ABC and Framebridge. Until next time, listen, learn, and advocate for justice.